Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest reversal by President Trump, who had signaled he would sign the CR, the continuing resolution the Senate passed on Wednesday, to avoid a government shutdown. But after criticism from Fox and Friends and an attack on his manhood from Ann Coulter, Trump is now saying he won't sign the stopgap funding bill unless he gets $5 billion for his wall. Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic and the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, joins us to discuss how Trump is lurching from one reality TV stunt to the next to distract the public from the many investigations closing in on him. Meanwhile, with the stock market plunging, Trump is more and more isolated from reality as the last of the adults in the White House are purged, with Secretary of Defense Mattis being forced out in February. We will assess what might prevent further catastrophic damage, particularly in foreign policy, since Trump is poised to withdraw the small but strategically vital U.S. force from Syria in a move that Putin, not surprisingly, is praising, which has all of Trump's top national security officials alarmed and is likely the reason why Mattis is heading out the door. Since the wheels are coming off the administration and Trump is about to inflict even greater damage, we will discuss what the American people can do short of being spectators to the country's descent into chaos, corruption, and collapse. Then we'll examine further the looming government shutdown and speak with an expert on public service, since federal public servants will be the collateral damage from Trump's ignorance and incompetence, since they will be not getting a paycheck over Christmas. Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University and the former director of the governmental studies program at the Brookings Institution, joins us to discuss the absurdity of shutting down the government over a snide remark from Ann Coulter and the positive sign amid the dysfunction that finally the legislative branch is doing its constitutional duty as a check and balance on the executive branch. Then finally, we'll look into the sneaky attempt to slip the Israel Anti-Boycott Act into the must-pass budget bill by Senators Cardin and Portman at the behest of AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and the Netanyahu government, who are alarmed by the growing support for the BDS boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement around the world. Miko Peled, a Israeli writer and activist and author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, whose activities would be criminalized by the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, joins us to discuss opposition to the act from the ACLU and Senators Sanders and Feinstein, who are calling for debate, not censorship, on the Israeli-Palestine issue. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, you're going to have to update your guide for the perplexed, let alone the disillusioned and the desperate and the not yet deported. I mean, what the hell is going on in Washington?
I've joked for a while that the next book would have to be called Run for Your Lives, and it's not a joke anymore. This is a crazy time, which in many ways was predictable, at least parts of it. It's been fairly clear for some time that if and as the noose tightens with the Mueller investigation combined with investigations by the New York Attorney General, the Southern District of New York, that Trump would not react well to it. It could get significantly worse. But one thing we know as the shutdown looms is that Trump displays two characteristics when trouble is on the horizon or has already emerged, especially through indictments, investigations, people turning evidence and other ways. The first is he looks for a distraction. He wants a shiny object that dominates the news and doesn't focus so much on evidence of his past behavior, present behavior, potential problems, including those of his family. And a shutdown is right at the top of the list of what can be a distraction. The second is he doubles down on trying to excite and move and motivate his base, even at the expense of his own partisans or the country as a whole. So he runs the idea of a shutdown by the public, by his own leaders in Congress. They don't react well. He appears to be backing down. And then all of a sudden, Ann Coulter, Tucker Carlson, even Fox and Friends turn on him, and he's going to double down on motivating the base. And this is not going to end well. Now, you combine that with the not just the decision to withdraw troops from Syria, but the way in which it was done over the objections of virtually every senior figure in the administration dealing with foreign policy, with the rumor that's out there today that we're going to get a similar announcement on our troops in Afghanistan, and then the news that Jim Mattis, really the only sane member of the cabinet and one with integrity, will be leaving in February. And when you look at Mattis's statement, which made it very clear that his views were out of step with those of Trump, the only way I can react is be afraid, be very afraid.
Well, but it's so dangerous. What happened yesterday over Syria is just completely insane that the United States would, or this president, doesn't understand what an extraordinary value a mere 2,000 boots on the ground is in terms of being a kind of cork in a bottle to stop wholesale bloodshed in Syria. And the U.S. is basically, with a very small force, is holding in check the Iranians, the Russians, the Assad regime, and the Turks. And if this goes ahead, the Kurds will be massacred, and the U.S. will give up its strategic leverage in that region for nothing. Now, there was a phone conversation with Erdogan, and again, you just don't know what kind of deals he makes with his fellow autocrats. That's what's scary about it. And Putin today, of course, in his annual end-of-the-year press conference, was praising Trump for this move. But the only good news, as far as I can tell, Norm Ornstein, is that in a couple of days' time, Trump may forget that he did this. But it's all about throwing red meat to his base.
I would be a little more worried for a couple of reasons. The same day that he announced the pullout of the troops from Syria, and just as an aside, I would add to what you said, we're also on the verge of deporting Vietnamese who worked with us in the Vietnam War and came over. The signal to the rest of the world is, don't ally with the United States. They can't be trusted. But the same day as that, we got the news from the Treasury Department that they're going to eliminate the sanctions on Oleg Deripaska, one of the autocrats who is closest to Putin, close to the Kremlin, and who also had an enormous leverage over Paul Manafort, who's on the verge of withdrawing any cooperation with the independent counsel Mueller. I just have a hard time believing that these things are unrelated. And this is just making Putin giddy, and he's doing what Putin wants. And at this point, his relationship with Erdogan is tied together with a hope that the Turks don't push too hard on MBS, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who ordered, it is clear, the brutal murder of the American resident journalist Khashoggi. So we're moving into a very bad territory here. The shutdown is not going to be the biggest piece of news at this point. It will reverberate. And one of the things that's so ironic about this shutdown and makes it clear that you have a gang that not only can't shoot straight, but that can't add one and one to make it two. The main agency that will be hit by a government shutdown to try and get a wall to protect America against the quote-unquote threat of the caravan and migrants coming in is the Department of Homeland Security. So most of the people working in the Border Patrol or working in Customs or the other areas of Homeland Security will continue to work because they will be designated as vital employees, but they won't get paid. So the people he's counting on are going to go for a period of time, which could be days or weeks or months. And certainly, Democrats are not going to give in on just giving him funding for the wall. The way out of this might be a deal which would be much worse than the one he was offered several months back, of money for his wall in return for the support for and passage of the Dreamers Act. He was offered $25 billion for a wall some time ago and rejected it because Stephen Miller and Tom Cotton and others around him said no to the Dreamers. Now, if he cuts a deal to get $5 billion and we get the Dreamers in return after disrupting government and really damaging a lot of employees and a lot of people who rely on agencies of government, he may try to declare victory. But it just goes to show yet again that Donald Trump didn't even read The Art of the Deal, much less write it.
And again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestsellers, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Policies of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was, and he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. But you mentioned a minute ago, Norm Ornstein, the idea that be afraid. Well, does that mean that we are literally at the mercy of the caprices of an ignorant, incompetent, and corrupt amateur in the White House?
Yeah, it does. you know, I think we could step back and reflect a little bit. That one, if we step back a long time, the framers were aware of the possibility of electing a president who had no values, was immoral, amoral, corrupt, and in other ways unsuited for office, and built in safeguards to keep that from happening. At the core of it was an independent Congress providing checks and balances. And we've had 2 years without that, and now we'll have a little bit of it, but not enough. But fortunately, at least there will be something with the Democratic House. But then if you move forward, and especially move to the period from the Second World War through the Cold War on, we have given increasing unilateral power to a president because of the threats, the external threats especially, with the assumption that we would have a president who was rational, whose goal was to protect America's national interest, who would surround himself with competent, sane people, and who would follow normal procedures before making decisions that could influence the future of the country. And now we are confronted with a very different situation, and what we see especially is with this abrupt withdrawal from Syria, that none of the safeguards are in place, And we're scrambling to try and figure out what to do about it. And unfortunately, we have, you know, there are a few Republicans in Congress who are upset about this. But they're the same ones who've enabled him over and over and over for 2 years. And all I'm seeing now is a bunch of tweets, which is not going to stop this kind of behavior. And we, you know, we have other stories today, Ian. One is we got a straight out lie from the Justice Department today saying that the acting attorney general had gotten clearance from the ethics people in the Justice Department so that he wouldn't have to recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller investigation. We found out this afternoon that all the ethics people there had told him he should recuse himself, and he just got a few cronies to tell him not to. So we have interference in the Mueller investigation. We have a nominee for attorney general who was only nominated because he wrote a 20-page memo attacking the Mueller investigation at its core. We don't know what will happen with all of that and whether Trump at some point could just use his unilateral power to declare a state of emergency and suspend civil liberties. But we also have no clue who will be nominated to be Secretary of Defense, and it could well be somebody utterly unsuited for the office.
Like Tom,
certainly
like
not
Tom
anybody
Cotton.
With the command of Mattis.
Right, like Tom Cotton.
Oh, God help us.
Well, that's one of the names that's been floated. So,
of course.
So, but at the end of the day, though, Norm Ornstein, what about us? What about the citizenry? Are we no better off than the orchestra playing on the deck of the Titanic as it sinks?
Well, I think we can say that at least we have a group of competent people coming in to run the House of Representatives, from Speaker Pelosi to committee chairs like Adam Schiff and Elijah Cummings and Richie Neal and also the chairs of committees like the Judiciary and Appropriations, Jerry Nadler among them. That will be helpful. But until we have a much larger uprising from the elites in both parties to try and put a stop to this, we could head down territory that will be very difficult to recover from.
And but just in closing, in the in this tyranny of the minority, shouldn't the majority stand up?
Well, yes, the majority should stand up, but what does that mean at this point? And keep in mind that some of the issues that we have and some of the headaches we have, assuming we survive Trump, won't go away when he departs. We're going to have a political system that increasingly creates questions of legitimacy in elections for the House, the Senate, and the President. A Senate increasingly unrepresentative of the diversity and the breadth of the population as a whole and not reflecting a majority. A House that potentially the Supreme Court could say that state actions to restrict partisan gerrymandering are unconstitutional, that would put us back again on a very bad path, and an electoral college that increasingly is going to leave us with elections where the winner of the presidency loses the popular vote, and next time it might not be by 3 million, as it was with Clinton, but by 8 or 9 million. So we've got a lot of headaches, but right now I think we're in a triage moment.
Well, Norm Ornstein, I thank you very much.
Have a nice day.
I was going to say, boy,
yeah.
It's bad enough covering the daily dose of doom and gloom, but
yeah.
I guess we got to keep it real. And I thank you for joining us, Norman.
Sure. Have a good holiday.
Thank you, Norman. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestsellers It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further the looming government shutdown.
Scream from the top of my lungs, what's going on in our same pain?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Paul Light, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. And previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. And he's the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform. And his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Light.
Thank you. Thank you.
And today there's been quite a bit of zigzagging going on at the White House. It looked as though the White House, in fact, signaled to the Senate that they were going to sign off on the continuing resolution. The Senate voted on it yesterday. Most of the senators have left town. And then Ann Coulter attacked Trump on Fox News and basically attacked his manhood to say he's not standing up for the wall. And he apparently was furious with her, but then he's reversed himself now and saying that he's telling Paul Ryan that he's not going to sign the continuing resolution. So here we are just before Christmas. It looks like we're going to have a government shutdown.
Well, and it looks like President Trump has decided to play the Grinch who stole payday. He set himself up for this. If he can't stand up to Ann Coulter, he's going to have to stand up to the federal workers who are denied pay next week. So, you know, he's put himself in this position. I'm actually delighted to see our institutions coming to a stalemate the old-fashioned way. This is how the system works, and the president is getting a lesson today in how American government is structured to make agreement difficult. And he's going to have to grow up here and recognize his own role in creating this impasse and recognize his own role in solving it. It's on him. He said so when he challenged Pelosi and Schumer. He said, I'm going to own this, and by golly, he is going to own this. And we'll see whether the American public aligns with them. They don't like the wall as much as he does. And I rather suspect that they're going to resonate to parodies of the president as the Grinch. It's a meme made in heaven. And we're going to see it rather quickly, I suspect.
Well, but I think you're absolutely right that finally the separation of powers and the constitutional checks and balances that the legislative branch has over the executive branch are finally being enacted. I don't think it's happening out of principle.
No.
It's happening because they want to go home, and half the Senate's already gone home. They don't.
Well, you and I have seen this movie before, and we may have even talked about it. I love talking to you, and we've had conversations about these kinds of situations. You know, the federal government has shut down many times over the last 20 years. You know, it's built into the system. What's comforting to me is that our institutions are grinding to a halt because they are exercising checks and balances. And I like that. And there was a lot of conversation during the campaign about the need to put a check on the president. This one is a double, quadruple, forward gainer kind of check where the institutions are cutting across unexpectedly. The House and the Senate disagreeing, moving on, so forth and so on. So I actually find this a bit comforting. It's not a hopeful situation from the standpoint of federal employees who are going to be hurt by this. And it's a bad signal to send to the American public as we go through a very rough period in the stock market and in the economy. But you know, at least now, you know, we have a moment where we can say, look, grow up, people, and do the right thing. And the president is going to have to confront here his own responsibilities. We'll see what happens.
So is there a chance? I mean, apparently Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is warning Republicans that they may have to return for a vote on Friday. And House Republicans, I don't think they can add the $5 billion that Trump wants for his wall because... go ahead.
Well, what's interesting about all of this is that the American public does not support the increase. But more importantly, the wall, such as it is, seems to be working. The president is tweeting constantly about record numbers of individuals stopped at the border. We are seeing a lot of cooperation now developing between the United States and Mexico on asylum seekers. To a certain extent, he's undermined his own case for the hordes of illegal undocumented immigrants crossing the border. I mean, he's in a very difficult situation. And, if he brings Congress back, forces them to come home, that's just another chit against him going forward. I think this is a reality testing moment for Donald Trump. And, he's starting to realize he ain't in charge of everything. And narcissism can only take you so far here. Sorry, but this is, a time for everybody to come together and say, we're adults here. We run this country, and the president has to get engaged. And Ann Coulter, incidentally, is not the president, not the vice president. She's got an opinion, and others differ with her. If he's going to let Ann Coulter decide policy, then let him appoint her to a cabinet position.
Do you think, though, since he's changed his mind in such a mercurial way on this issue, as you mentioned in the White House meeting with Schumer and Pelosi, which was very much a kind of reality TV setup, because he was having a negotiation with them in private, and then he brought the press in and suddenly changed into his role as the the tough guy, and made that statement that he would take responsibility, and then apparently the White House then signaled that maybe they didn't think it was a good idea to shut the government down, and then now he's changed himself again. So one of the things that, for example, yesterday I covered the tweet that he put out where he's suddenly going to pull the 2,000 troops out of Syria, which has got the entire national security establishment freaked out and blindsided a bunch of Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and others. The possibility, though, for as alarming as that is in terms of foreign policy and an insane strategic retreat on the part of the United States from a situation where they actually hold some pretty powerful cards and have a very, cheap situation with only 2,000 boots on the ground exercising an enormous amount of influence and essentially stopping a massive bloodbath in Syria.
Right.
As crazy as that is, the comforting news is that in a couple of days' time, he may forget that he said it. So will that be our out here that maybe, tomorrow he'll say, oh, it's okay, maybe we should let everybody get a paycheck at Christmas, including, by the way, and I'd like your opinion on this, Paul, are the Secret Service people that are supposed to guard him down at Mar-a-Lago, he's going down there tomorrow, Friday, are they going to get paid?
I think they will get paid. They are essential federal employees, and the shutdown really pertains to non-essential federal employees. But look, it's been a bad couple of weeks for Donald Trump, no doubt about it. He dared the Federal Reserve, damned them for imagining an increase in the interest rate. They raised it. He's dared the Senate. He's dared the House. It's been a bad week because Donald Trump is starting to realize that the president of the United States gives you a bully pulpit. You have the power to persuade. You don't have the power to order. This is a very finely tuned system that was made for stalemate, and he's starting to learn it. I might recommend that he read my American Government book, American Government 101. I mean, he's learning that this system is not at his command, and he's learning very quickly that the president ain't no boss. The president is a persuader, and he's not been very good at it this week. In fact, he's been downright awful. His messaging has been off kilter. He's been insulting, demeaning. When you look back at that meeting with Schumer and Pelosi, they're just sitting there saying, bring it on, Mr. President. He didn't see it. And they dared him. They baited him into saying, I'll own this shutdown. Well, Mr. President, I'm sure they're saying today, you do own this shutdown. Make our days on this one, because he's going to lose on this. He's got to backtrack. He's just got to do it.
But, Paul Light, since you have studied the public service and the federal public servants for so long and in such depth, the collateral damage are these people who've been vilified. You know, a lot of damage has been done to the public service by the cabinet appointees that he's put in there, because he's basically putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. The people that he puts in there are dedicated to dismantling the very government departments they head up. But, for example, if this shutdown happens, 80,000 IRS employees won't be going to work. They won't get a paycheck. The national parks will be locked at night and won't open in the morning. I mean, this is, needless to say, it's Christmas time. It just, on a human level, it seems capricious that these hardworking people, who are so often vilified, should be the collateral damage, either because of some guy's ego or incompetence or both.
Well, I love talking to you. I mean, you've got a way of putting things that's right on. So it's a joy. What I'm going to say is that if I were a Fed right now, I might be saying, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost. And they might be feeling a little bit better that the House and the Senate are locking down on this issue. And the president right now is on the hot seat. He may dodge. He may pull out of it. He may figure out a way to sign everything and restore his sense of honor with Ann Coulter. Who knows? But I think feds have been looking for this kind of principle-centered standoff for some time. We've seen it before. We've seen the president's narcissism at work before. But what I'm seeing here, I think, is a restoration of ordinary business. Now, you've heard this, or regular order. You've heard this from Congress. This is the way the system is supposed to work. It's not supposed to be easy. And you know what? The system is not working today just as it was designed to not work. No presidential tweets, no presidential posturing. This is the House and Senate doing their job, and they're going to have to bring him to a conversation about resolution. He ain't going to get $5 billion. I bet you on that, Ian. I just think he ain't going to get that. He may get something. But, you know, that border that he thinks is so porous seems to be working pretty well, and he celebrates that in his tweets. So this may be the beginning of a period of accountability for the president, and that makes me feel good. It would make me feel good if that was Hillary Clinton in office, if that was Obama or George W. You know, accountability is a good thing, and they're going to hold him to the fire. I'm feeling a little bit better today about how our system works, believe it or not. And you might say, wow, this guy is nuts, the last interview ever. But I do feel like, wow, this is the way it's supposed to work. We've been here before. This will be resolved, and the president's going to come to some agreement and understand a little bit better how this system was designed to work, or not work in this case.
And just let me correct something that I said. Ann Coulter, actually, who's been a very ardent Trump supporter, it was a blog post of hers in which she called Trump gutless for caving in on the wall. And she also went on, told this to the Daily Caller. Well, so it wasn't actually on Fox, which
well,
I...
Well, she's got her
right. But
supporters
she's,
to play.
Yeah, man, she's getting plenty of play, I can guarantee you.
Yeah, but she's losing advertisers, so... I mean, this is a complicated little play going on here, but at the end of the day, as I said before, Ann Coulter is not president, and she can push Donald Trump only so far. It's an interesting situation that will be the subject of conversations about the president's attitudes, in this era, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, if she can make him turn the corner, turn around, so be it. But I think he ends up a loser. The only question in this particular event is how much of a loser is he going to be? He's going to have to back off, I think. But I've been wrong before, my friend. And I may wake up tomorrow. I may I go home in 15 minutes and say, oh, my goodness, you know, why did I say that? But I'm just feeling a little bit better about how the system is working right now.
Well, you'll be forgiven because I have the same problem covering Trump. You get whipsawed all the time.
And
by the time we finish this interview, the situation may have reversed itself.
But you and I will both go to our computers and hit the Trump tweet button and see what he's saying.
Right. But just in closing, though, there is another path for Trump, and that is that he, for example, one of his campaign promises was to get rid of NAFTA. Well, essentially all he did was change the name of NAFTA.
Yep.
And, you know, very, very minor changes to NAFTA. But he managed to sort of ballyhoo it up into some big renegotiation and a completely different treaty, and therefore I satisfied my campaign promise. Is there any way that he can do this? Because he's already sort of hinted that maybe, I think he actually made the statement that even though Mexico is not paying for the wall, they really are paying for the wall, because the deal that I did over NAFTA means that we're going to make so much money that at Mexico's expense that actually pays for the wall. So is it possible he could just basically play some semantical trick and pretend that he's fulfilled his promise?
I you know, this one, that particular maneuver is so oblique that he may be able to get by with it. I doubt it. His voters are, you know, the working middle class Americans out on the farms and in the factories, you know, they know how the budget works, and you can only play this game so far. He may be able to get away with that one. And Americans don't really understand how these treaties work. Maybe he can finesse it, but the House and the Senate are not going to give him a down payment of $5 billion on the wall. And most Americans, or a substantial majority of Americans, say we don't need a new wall. The current one is working well enough. It stopped the caravan, for goodness sakes. You know, so, you know, therein lies the rub for Donald Trump. He makes a crisis out of everyday events. But at some point, people say, well, wait a second, why do we need $5 billion for a wall that you just said was working? It stopped the caravan. So, you know, at some point, you get into these traps, and the bank comes calling and says, you know, you got to pay your bills. And we may be seeing the beginning of that, or we may just be seeing our institutions pulling together a little bit and doing their jobs. I'll take either at this point.
Well, Paul Leiter, thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure entirely. It's a gas. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Leiter, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. And he's the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform. And his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the sneaky attempt to slip the Israel Anti-Boycott Act into the must-pass budget bill by Senators Cardin and Portman at the behest of AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and the Netanyahu government. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Miko Peled, who is a Israeli writer and activist dedicated to tearing down the separation wall and advocating the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. He travels regularly to Palestine and Israel, where he speaks, works with popular resistance, and has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activities. He blogs at MikoPeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mikko Peled.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Mikko. And you're on Capitol Hill today. You've been lobbying, and from what I can tell, the Cardin-Portman bill, which is they've tried to attach to the spending bill, which now the president is threatening not to sign the continuing resolution and might well shut down the government. But let's talk about this legislation, and there's some opposition generated against it by Senator Sanders and by Senator Dianne Feinstein. But first of all, from what I can tell, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act would, it's kind of targeted to people like you, isn't it? I mean, it would put you out of business, or actually it would criminalize your activities.
Well, there's apparently there are several different iterations of this bill, and generally speaking, it doesn't look good for them. It doesn't look like it's going to pass, like it's going to go through this time. And I think the fact that they're trying to kind of sneak it in at the last minute as part of something else and during a lame duck session just shows how desperate they are, and that they know, or at least they have a good sense, that the next Congress is going to be far more progressive too, and won't allow this kind of nonsense. But the way the bill is presented now, it's as though it's trying to amend the Export Administration Act of 1979, and has to do with that sort of thing. So in other words, it's supposedly not going to infringe on people's First Amendment rights, and it won't infringe on people's rights to boycott and so forth. But it's actually it's much more ambitious than that, actually. So I was sitting today at the office of Jerry Connolly, who's the Democrat from Virginia, and his staffer was bending over backwards to say that this was not infringing on First Amendment rights and this was not unconstitutional, but it seeks to amend the Export-Import Bank Act of 1945. And basically, it's a matter of foreign policy, and the United States has a right to set foreign policy. And within that framework, it still says it's intended to penalize people who call for boycott against citizen residents of Israel or the state of Israel or organizations or commercial institutions that work with the government of Israel. So basically, it is trying to criminalize the call for boycott against Israel, and why in the world they would need to put it there if really, as they say, it doesn't limit anything is exactly the issue. They're trying to present it, but then to say, well, actually, it doesn't do anything bad and it doesn't limit us. But they can't have it both ways. The fact that they want to pass this bill shows that they want to limit our right and the right of American citizens to boycott anybody and to call for boycott of any entity, state or non-governmental that they choose. But again, it doesn't look promising to them at all. It doesn't seem like it's going to go through.
So the BDS, as it's called, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, is basically been gathering steam, has it not, in recent years? And that seems to be what Israel's worried about and what the Netanyahu government's worried about. And they found allies, obviously, in Senator Ben Cardin, a Maryland Democrat, and Senator Rob Portman, an Ohio Republican. But I take it AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is pushing this strongly on Capitol Hill. And conversely, J Street, the Progressive American Pro-Israel Group, is against it, along with the ACLU. So you're there on Capitol Hill today. What's the sense of the deployment of forces on both sides?
Well, I think it seems like there's been some negotiating going back and forth, and they are getting some pushback from some of the senators and some of the members of representatives of the House of Representatives, some of the congresspeople as well. So they're not really getting what they want. I think people have an aversion to try to sneak things in at the last minute, especially during a lame duck session, because it seems it is dishonest, and it seems dishonest. I think there's a much larger picture here, though, than goes beyond the boundaries of the United States. I mean, I was at the Labour Party conference, the UK Labour Party conference in September in Liverpool, and you have the leader of the Labour Party, probably the only leader, the only significant political figure in the world today, who dares to say that if he was elected, he will stop arms sales to Israel and he will hold Israel accountable for its war crimes and for detention of children and so forth. Then you have the entire conference on the final day, everybody holding Palestinian flags and talking about the rights of Palestinians. This is a great cause of concern. Now, on top of that, you've got three new members of Congress that are in the incoming Congress who are obviously supporting the Palestinian rights and have come out and talked about BDS quite freely. Two of them support BDS outright. You've got the Betty McCollum bill, which talks about the right to stop or to make sure that U.S. funding does not go to the detention and arrest and torture of children, which it does. So they're looking at some very, very serious opposition to the state of Israel and to its policies, and they are terrified. I mean, they're absolutely terrified. So they are, I think they're going to pull all the stops and do everything they can, and still they are not going to be able to win, and still I don't think they're going to be able to pass this.
And when you talk about that, you're talking about Netanyahu and his government.
I'm talking about Netanyahu and his government, all the way from Netanyahu and his government. And he personally is involved. We know that, and we know that he's certainly involved with the many of the charges, the false charges against Jeremy Corbyn in the UK about anti-Semitism and support for terrorism and that sort of thing. All the way to their agents here is in AIPAC and different Zionist groups in the UK and other places to make sure that these anti-BDS laws are passed one way or the other. But it's being diluted and diluted and diluted because there's quite a bit of pushback because of First Amendment issues, because of the ACLU is opposing it. So it's not as easy for them as I think it used to be. And I think they're feeling some serious pressure, which is very, very good, of course, because it shows that BDS is making some traction and getting support.
So when you talk about the First Amendment, of course, the First Amendment only operates here in the United States. It's certainly the British still have libel laws that go back to the American Revolution. And the same is in other countries like Australia. So, but nevertheless, what I find offensive about it, and this is, you know, irrespective of taking a position on BDS or Israel or Palestine, is quite simply that it just seems arrogant to me that Netanyahu is basically saying it's my way or the highway, that there's only one narrative. And I see it as a form of censorship if you can't have... In fact, that's what Senator Bernie Sanders and Dianne Feinstein are saying. You know, you can't just basically say that you can only discuss one side of an issue. They're basically saying, you know, that what is needed is a debate. Well, isn't what Netanyahu and company and the two senators, Cardin and Portman, who are carrying their water, aren't they basically saying there's only one narrative here, there's only one side, and you can't talk about any alternative?
Absolutely. And the thing is that in many ways they're right, because it's a slippery slope, and Netanyahu knows it, and AIPAC knows it. And all the different Zionist agents, all these groups and lobbies, and know it very well, because once you start poking holes at the narrative, at the Zionist narrative, then it all falls apart. It is a zero-sum game, because you either recognize, if you either accept Israel as it is, or you can't accept it at all. Because it is a racist entity, and it is a racist endeavor, and that's exactly what it was from the very beginning. There is no Israel without racism. There is no Israel without apartheid. There is no Israel without the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. This is the Israel that exists. This is what they created. So, and they know very well that if they allow any holes in that narrative, which shows Israel as being perfectly democratic and on the right side of every issue, then pretty soon there will be no narrative and the whole thing is going to sink, because it is that weak. And they have no other choice. In other words, if they start compromising, then they're going to find themselves in a very, very, in an impossible situation. And I believe that that is exactly what is going to happen, because it's impossible to maintain the stance that they hold for very long. People start looking and people start realizing that Israel is not this perfect democracy, that Israel does have racist laws, that Israel does discriminate against Palestinians, whether they're citizens of Israel, or whether they live in Gaza, or whether they are refugees who have no right to return. So people are beginning to realize this and wake up to this and ask questions, and that is exactly what is scaring them, what is so frightening to them. So they do not want the debate. They do not want. And they've seen also things like, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders in his debate with Hillary Clinton coming out against Israeli attacks on Gaza. It didn't hurt him. You look at Jeremy Corbyn in the UK with all these accusations thrown at him of anti-Semitism. Doesn't hurt him. You look at Betty McCollum. You look at the new members of Congress who are coming in, some of whom are very progressive on this issue. They got elected, so it's not hurting politicians to support the Palestinian cause. It's not hurting politicians when they come out for BDS. Quite the opposite. People appreciate their honesty, and you know their constituents have their own issues, so that's how they vote. And so these are serious failures for the state of Israel and for AIPAC and all of its other Zionist agents here in the U.S. And they're realizing that it's a very slippery slope. If they start allowing this, if they don't fight this as hard as they can, they will eventually lose. And I think they will eventually lose. I think it's inevitable.
Well, I've always thought it was a bit of a paradox that the right-wing Israelis, pro-Israelis in this country, like Sheldon Adelson, have tremendous traction and influence. And of course, he's basically has a newspaper in Israel dedicated promoting Netanyahu and his policies. But they don't have the numbers. They got the money, but they don't have the numbers. It's still consistently something like 2/3 of American Jewry vote Democratic and tend to be progressive. So there's always been that disconnect. But the clever thing that the Israelis did under Shamir was to create this movement, which is called Christian Zionism. And that's a very powerful movement. That's responsible for the Trump administration moving the embassy to Jerusalem, etc. So it's almost like the Israeli right doesn't really need AIPAC as much. And it was always AIPAC was always powerful in the Democratic Party, even though it's also has recruited a lot of Republican sympathizers. But my sense is the really powerful lobby that Israel has is the Christian Zionist movement.
That's absolutely true. That is a very serious lobby, but that too has its weaknesses, because even Israelis who rely on them and love them, their support, look at them as a bunch of very rich but complete lunatics. I mean, they make fun of their belief system. They make fun of their religious, observances and what they make of Israel and their religious ideology, if you will, as well. I mean, I think Israel's entire argument and its entire legitimacy is falling apart because it relies on things like the Christian right. It relies on politicians like Donald Trump. And it relies, and his group there, the son-in-law and so forth. And it relies on AIPAC, which is losing ground, really, in the face of, and even though it's well-funded and very well-oiled and they have their talking points and they've got their Hasbara, their PR system, which is a very, very well-oiled machine, but it's falling apart in the face of the Palestinian call for BDS, which is mostly organized by, you know, ragtag volunteers who are just very, very dedicated. So they're in deep trouble. I mean, whether it's J Street, whether it's AIPAC, whether it's the Christian right, the Zionist narrative is falling apart. The Zionist narrative that was brought to America probably in the most powerful way was, you know, the movie Exodus in 1960. And if anybody hasn't seen it, you can see the trailer and it gives you an idea what a, you know, thickly, sugared up, romantic, heroic narrative they created with that movie. And it's all untrue. It's all based on lies. It's all based on a myth that doesn't exist. The entire legitimacy of Zionism is based on a lie. It's based on a history that never took place. It's based on a narrative that was untrue. And you can only hold on, you can only survive on that for so long. And when you look at the laws that are being passed in the Israeli Knesset day in and day out, and when you look at the reality in Gaza, And when you look at the children being arrested and detained and tortured by the Israeli authorities, and on and on and on, you look at the racism and the discrimination of Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, you know, lack of water, lack of services, and so forth, lack of opportunity, not to mention their land disappearing and so forth. It's falling apart. And at some point, there's no way to justify it anymore. I mean, I just did a debate in London at King's College. There's a snippet of it, and there's a video on it that, you know, they threw on YouTube, on Facebook. The talking points have not changed. Their talking points have nothing new, nothing fresh, because the reality is that you cannot defend what is indefensible. You can make up more and more and more stories, but eventually people realize you cannot defend what is indefensible. And what Israel does, and really the very existence of the state of Israel from the very beginning, is indefensible.
Well, just in closing, Mikko Pellet, there's a case down in Texas of a school district stopped paying an employee, a speech pathologist, because she wouldn't promise not to boycott Israel. And I'm wondering, I know this fellow that Betsy DeVos hired in the Department of Education, Kenneth Marcus, is a very zealous pro-Israel, anti-BDS type. So you're saying that they're not having success, or they're on the defensive, or they're not winning anymore. But it seems like, well, let me ask you this. Is Kenneth Marcus being effective? And what's the story of this woman being down in Texas losing a job because she wouldn't promise to stop boycotting Israel?
Well, on the one hand, you know, on the face of it, it seems like, you know, having him at doing the job that he does at the Department of Education and so forth is a huge win for Israel and for the Zionists. But I don't know that there's anybody who can defend what was done to this story where I don't think she was a teacher, like you say, she was a therapist, losing her job because she wouldn't. She wouldn't sign this, and there were other cases after the storms where people couldn't get their insurance policies, couldn't get their insurance money if they didn't also promise some kind of a statement against BDS, boycotting Israel or something. I mean, this is absurd, and this is not doing their case any good. I mean, this is probably the worst PR they could possibly have. And, you know, I mean, how crazy can this get? What has this got to do with anything? What has this got to do with, what does her job and her work have anything to do with Israel and boycotting Israel? And why are they infringing on her right to do whatever she wants in terms of her thinking and her politics and her boycotting or not boycotting? So it's reached a really absurd levels, which I think only backfire. I think it only shows how desperate they are. And I think it only shows that they are becoming weaker and weaker, because this is terrible PR for them. And it's unjustifiable. There's no way to justify these types of actions other than being, completely, completely myopic and politically motivated.
Well, Mikko Pellet, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mikko Pellet, who's an Israeli writer and activist dedicated to tearing down the separation wall and advocating the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. He travels regularly to Palestine and Israel, where he speaks, works with popular resistance, and has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activities. And he blogs at mikkopellet.com, and he's the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. Standing along the side of the pickup truck.
Took the kids to the park and disappeared by